Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 162 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling The Old World Order is Dead. Long live the New World Order. 2. The continuation of a presentation by Peter Zion, global strategist and author, who spoke November 15, 2019 at the Tri-State Grain Growers Convention. A global strategist is a lot like a long-range meteorologist in that both look to past behavior in order to make predictions about the future. And as we know, long-range weather forecasters are not always accurate. They are, however, correct enough that it's perilous to completely discount their predictions. Because the future springs from the past, Zion is also an historian, but not the stuffy kind who sit in upholstered leather chairs and smoke pipes. Zion is your smart, hip uncle, telling you things about the world you never imagined while describing world leaders in most unflattering lights and exposing their underlying motivations. Zion spoke for more than an hour during his presentation. Needless to say, I've edited this episode for length, which means unless you attended the luncheon where he spoke and heard him in person, you're missing out. So make a plan to attend the 2020 Tri-State Grain Growers Convention in Coeur d'Alene next November. Judging from Zion's comments, President Trump has so upset the world order's apple cart that, to mix metaphors, there's no putting Humpty Dumpty back together again. Here, Zion describes the two different approaches world leaders adopted for dealing with Trump.
When Trump was elected, most world leaders could fall into one of two buckets. Bucket number one, you got the world leaders like, you know, if the Americans are going to drop the baton of leadership, maybe there's room for us to take up a more prominent role. Macron of France, Trudeau of Canada, Xi of China. Bucket number two, where the world leaders like, holy crap, do the Americans have any clue what they just did? Let's keep our heads down, try not to offend anyone, and just wait it out. This is Merkel of Germany, Turnbull of Australia, May of Britain. The Koreans couldn't do either of those. The South Koreans, President Moon of South Korea, he knows that there's no version of a world without the United States in it, in which his country continues to exist. If it's not North Korea, it's Japan. If it's not Japan, it's China. It's a tough neighborhood. He has to have U.S. troops on the ground. So at his first opportunity, he walked into the Oval Office. He said, what do you need? We've got this coarse free trade deal. What do you need? What do we need to change? What do I need to give in on in order to keep you engaged? Technical talks were over in 6 weeks. Is it enough to keep the Americans involved when the day finally arrives? Moon does not know. Neither does Trump. Neither do I. Nobody knows. But without that capitulation, the answer would have absolutely been no. The two big sectors that benefit in the United States from this, manufacturing and agriculture, specifically pork and beef. Next up are the Mexicans. Now, on the left, you've got Peña. He's the outgoing leader. He is, from the American point of view, by far the best partner we have ever had south of the border. Pro-American, fluent English speaker, pro-business, pro-trade, wanted deals on migration and drugs and everything. He was always calling the Obama White House, and Obama wouldn't pick up the phone. He tried calling the Trump White House. Trump would pick up the phone to insult him. Hideous series of bipartisan wasted opportunities. Now that new guy, the one on the right, that's Lopez Obrador, aka AMLO, and he's a piece of work. He combines the anti-foreigner sentiment of Donald Trump with the political corruption of Hillary Clinton and the shrillness of Elizabeth Warren and the blind ideology of Ted Cruz and the pathological refusal to do basic mathematics of Bernie Sanders. Just all wrapped up in one dude. And he's an egomaniac. But that doesn't mean he's dumb. And he looked at Trump, and he's like, you know, it's like looking in a mirror. if I get caught in a bipartisan, in a binational pissing contest with Donald Trump, it will consume my administration. And I see myself kind of like Bill Clinton, leader of domestic renewal. I don't want that. So AMLO reached out to Pena and he reached out to Trump in the days after his election but before his inauguration. He said, look, if you guys can figure out what NAFTA 2 looks like and get it signed, I will not reopen talks and I will spearhead ratification personally. He has proven to be a man of his word. Ratification happened over the summer. And Mexico, remember this? Look at those bottom four lines. See how it just kind of goes out and then drops? You guys remember what happened 25 years ago, right? NAFTA 1. Most agriculture in Mexico is subsistence, which means that as soon as you guys start competing with their farmers head-to-head, you wipe the floor with them. And so they move off the farms and into the cities. And when you do that, kids go from being free labor to really expensive pets. They stop growing their own food. Mexico is our number one agricultural destination market, and it will be for the rest of our lives. And so in NAFTA 1, there were a lot of arguments within Mexico about how much to liberalize agriculture. We get to NAFTA 2, like, bring it on, we need it all. Pork, wheat, soy, corn, beef, all of it, all of it, all of it, all of it, we're hungry. It's not going to change for decades. We're pretty far north here. Do we have any Canadians in the room? Wow. Security here is shockingly good. This is Chrystia Freeland. She's the Canadian foreign minister. Now, in my personal opinion, she's one of the 10 smartest people in Western civilization alive today. 4 years ago, I beat her in a debate. But we're not keeping score. She's so smart that she realized 5 minutes into her first meeting with Donald Trump that she was absolutely the wrong person for the job. We all have our little hang-ups, and Trump's biggest one is he feels he must be the smartest person in the room. As long as she was in the same time zone, that was never going to happen. She knew she had to step back from active public management of American-Canadian relations. She needed somebody to put in front, someone with a nice smile, great head of hair, a tight outfit, and a tighter body, but absolutely nothing going on between the ears. Someone who would just stand there and nod and smile, and so that Trump's internal monologue could fill in the gaps, and it was all very complimentary. And she found the perfect person. Justin Trudeau is by far Donald Trump's favorite world leader because he's not allowed to speak. Now, the Canadians call this the hug offensive, and it was working gloriously until about a year ago. Canada hosted the G7 summit last year, and as host, Justin Trudeau actually had to open his mouth. And for the first time in Trump's term, what he heard clashed with the monologue. And relations literally collapsed in an hour. Now, when the NAFTA talks were going on, we would go down to Mexico City and we'd have real talks about the digital economy and agriculture and rules of origin and manufacturing. We didn't always see eye to eye, of course. You know, it was a negotiation. It wasn't an imposition like it was with the Koreans. But we had good talks. They were taken seriously. We made a lot of progress fairly quickly. This down a little bit. But then we'd come up to Ottawa and they'd like, you know what, today we want to talk about the worker rights of left-handed transvestite handicapped people. And we're like, they were trying to get concessions out of us to push their internal agenda. And we're like, what about what's going on in the world right now makes you think you have any leverage at all? It really comes down to this map. This is how the Canadians see themselves. They are on the flight path for Soviet nuclear weapons to the United States. And during the Cold War, this meant that there was no version of American security that did not automatically, reflexively, for free, also protect Canada. Now, the Canadians could have used this as leverage in security negotiations. They could have been security-free riders. To their credit, they did the absolute opposite. Whenever they saw an international crisis, they were always the first ones to pick up the phone, call the American president, and say, "We see what's going on. We're here for you. How can we help?" But that doesn't mean they're dumb. They used that leverage, they just didn't use it in defense matters. Because usually at the end of that phone call, they'd say, oh yeah, and now we've got all that worked out, just one little thing. We'd love to have a little bit more trade access for Ontarian Aerospace and maybe some Quebecois dairy. 70 times they carved exemptions out of American trade law. All of those exemptions were rolled into NAFTA 1. None of them were rolled into NAFTA 2 because the United States doesn't see the world this way anymore. We're not worried about a Russian assault, which means that everything that makes Canada special, everything that gives them a leverage over the United States, everything that gives them a position in international affairs is gone. They're just another country now. And for the United States, is looking at a smaller and smaller global footprint, Canada goes from like country number 15 or 20 that we think about to like country number 3 or 4. And if they have to trade on their own merits, they don't do nearly as well. The sector that got the most out of NAFTA 2 as regards Canada is ag. Dairy, poultry, eggs, wheat. Shinzo Abe thought he had a deal. He did everything right. He was the first world leader to visit Trump after the election, the second world leader to visit Trump after the actual inauguration. He came bearing gifts of golden golf clubs. He lost to Trump hideously in 18 rounds of golf. Egos were stroked, asses were kissed. He did everything right, and they hit it off famously. They struck a series of deals on intelligence sharing and military cooperation. Better than some of the deals we had during the Cold War. It was like real progress. Went home thinking, you know, this guy's kind of not my kind of person, but I can manage it. The alliance is safe. A couple months later, the Trump administration slaps Japan with steel and aluminum tariffs and starts threatening automotive tariffs. Abe comes rushing back. He says, "What the hell, man? I thought we had a deal. I thought you and the carriers were going to be in front, the Japanese and all the other Asian allies were going to be lined up behind you, we were going to face down the Chinese together, and you were going to pay for everything." Trump's like, "Oh, guns for butter, like the global order. Yeah, I read about that once." I'm kidding, I don't read. No, that's over. And don't think for a second that you can call up the Koreans and the Australians and the Thais and build up this pan-Asian alliance to force us into multilateral trade talks to get more concessions. Yeah, we barely did that for Canada. Abe, a little depressed, goes home, breaks out his copy of The Art of the Deal and rereads it, becomes convinced that this is a negotiating tactic. So he plays hard to get, doesn't answer Washington's calls for a few weeks. And then he looks up, and in less than a month, the Americans have a new deal with the Koreans and the Mexicans and the Canadians. And four of Japan's largest trading partners have already reorganized themselves into a post-order network. And you know who the biggest trading partner remaining is? China. Don't know if you knew this, but Japan and China have a little bit of bad blood. So he caved. Bilateral talks started in less than 6 weeks. They finished up a month ago. Japan, like Korea, like Canada, had to cave on everything. The sector that got the most access? Ag, beef being the number one product. There are 30 or 40 significant reasons why China will not be a unified country a decade from now. We are in the final years of China. If you're selling to China right now, it's like selling into American construction for residential in 2006. You are selling into the peak. Don't get used to it. This is the biggest reason. It's those islands, Japan, Taiwan, the Philippines, Indonesia, Singapore. The Chinese call it the first island chain. It blocks their access to the rest of the world. There is no period in Chinese history, 3,500 years of Chinese history, no single period, where the Chinese have been able to economically integrate with the world beyond that chain. Well, that's not quite true. There's one exception. Today, under the order, because the Americans have forced everyone to be on the same side. All the U.S. has to do to destroy China as an entity is go home. That we can handle. And that's exactly what's happening. That's the long-term problem. Here's the short-term problem. Lighthizer's in charge of the trade talks. He has been waiting since the 1990s to lower the boom on the Chinese. He sees them as the first, the biggest, the greatest threat to the American economy, and he is going to take them down. Remember, this is the guy who wrote the World Trade Organization Charter. He's not anti-free trade. He's very pro-free trade if everyone follows the rules. In his opinion, the Chinese have abused the rules for so long that the order itself is now broken. And if he has to destroy the remnants of the order in order to force something that is more advantageous to Americans, he will do so. It's kind of like killing your own kid. But he's committed. And the real kicker is twofold. Number one, everyone else in the Trump administration sees the order itself as the problem. This is as pro-trade as it gets. The second kicker, of the 177,000 Democrats that are trying to get on the ticket, all of them say that Trump is being too soft on trade. Trump is now what a pro-trade politician looks like in the United States. Folks, this game is over. You'll get through it. Now, it won't be a straight road from here to here. For the most part, the U.S. economy is immune to everything that happens abroad. There are a couple of exceptions. First, Silicon Valley. You've all, on your iPhone, you know, see it says, made in China, designed in California. We all know what that means. It's like the United States, the entire manufacturing supply chain for electronics is not on this continent. It's elsewhere. Which means that when you break down that system, Silicon Valley is probably the part of the country that's going to suffer the most because a design does not help you connect with the world. It has to be built, and relocating that is a multi-year process. Now, for the most part, the Chinese, the Asians in general, aren't targeting this sector because it hurts them as much as Silicon Valley. That leaves you. These are some major American agricultural products ranked by the percentage of the output that is exported. You, of course, are there in orange. Bottom line, you're just too damn good at what you do. Out of every 4 calories the average American farmer produces, one of those calories has to be exported. That is where our weakness is in trade talks. It's the only sector where really there's exposure, and so it is the sector that everybody goes after. There's not really any way around that. I can guarantee you that on the backside of this, when the global order is gone, we will see collapses in agricultural output around the world, collapses that won't hit you at all. You are going through the tough years right now. I can't offer you a lot of solace on that. Now, you have been living in an environment almost custom designed to cause you problems. The United States sublimated its economic needs in order to achieve a security goal. That security goal has been achieved. We're now breaking away from the entire system. And for most farmers in most of the world, that is an unmitigated disaster, which means between the trade talks and the end of the order, the pendulum is shifting back to you. But the trade talks and the end of the order, those are only 2 of the factors. Everything else in the global system right now that is changing also argues for your long-term success. Let's start with capital. That bump in the middle, well, this is the private credit curve. Total private credit from all institutions to all non-financial institutions. So interfinancial noise, ignore that. This is everything else. Now, that bump in the middle is 2007. That's the subprime crisis. From the beginning of the chart in 2000 until that bump, we doubled total private credit in this country. That's too much. That's too fast. We had the subprime crisis. We had a recession. We lost 5% of our headline GDP. Since then, we've recovered. The curve is going positive again, but at a much more sustainable rate, something much closer to the century average. It does not mean that we are recession-proof, but it does mean that the next recession, when it hits, probably won't be financial. That's a good thing. Financial recessions tend to hit a lot harder. Now, this is our baseline. Remember, that bump in the middle is a doubling. This is the data in absolute terms, and this is the data in relative terms. Again, that bump in the middle is a double. Everybody with me? Okay. Here's the Eurozone. In the time that we had a doubling, they had a tripling. Their financial crisis hit harder, lasted longer. Several EU countries, most notably Italy, have yet to recover to where they were in 2006. China is now the most overcredited country in human history in both relative and absolute terms. Every country, every company that has ever followed this version of financial models has eventually crashed hard. And the Chinese have now pushed it further and farther than anyone ever. If you want to look really quick at the markets of the future, you've got to think about what U.S. policy is going to be like. Now, we've been here before. Back in the late 1800s and early 1900s, we had a period where we were coming out of Reconstruction, and we were too internally divided as a country to really think about foreign affairs. Sound familiar? And so what happened was the U.S. State Department and the U.S. Defense Department just kind of took a passive attitude towards everything, and it was up to individual business leaders to go out and forge their way in the world if they had interest and inclination and money. We called it dollar diplomacy. U.S. political and military power would follow the businesses, not the other way around. That's where we're going. The places where you're going to be going, therefore, are here. Any country that is lit up is a country that has reasonable energy access, even in the new environment, and a positive demographic structure, meaning that there are going to be more mouths to feed. The difference between the two colors is that the blues really don't have to worry about anyone shooting at them, whereas the greens have some security problems. So if you're very low risk, you're going to be going blue. If you have a little tolerance and don't mind getting shot at every once in a while, you'll probably go green. These are the growing markets in the world. These are all of the growing markets in the world. Few thoughts. Number one, the safest one, the biggest growing one, is also the closest one. That's Mexico. Pun intended, that is your bread and butter. Number two, the other side of the Caribbean. Colombia has its act together. Venezuela does not. But collectively, the two of them import almost 3/4 of the food that they consume. They're in the tropics. They can only do so much. So whether Venezuela wildly succeeds or wildly fails, they are going to have to import food. That right there, those two countries, that's another 100 million people. Next up, Brazil. Brazil ceases to be a major agricultural player in the way that we understand it. Big baton drop for people to pick up if they've got the capacity. Four, India. 1.3 billion people, they're not going anywhere. And if you change the global environment on tech and equipment and finance and inputs, their yields have to go down. But they've still got 1.3 billion people. Fourth, Southeast Asia, specifically Vietnam, Myanmar, Indonesia. You've got almost a billion people in this region who are largely immune to the changes that are racking the international system. They don't have a history of going to war with one another. They've got a great multi-step supply chain system that integrates them. There's only one problem. They're too urbanized to grow their own food. If you guys haven't put some stakes down in this region, strongly suggest you start.
The U.S. wheat industry, through U.S. Wheat Associates, has put down stakes in the region, and more stakes are coming as Indonesia's market looks for consistent supply as nearby Australia's crop suffers through ongoing drought. Judging from Zion's report, it appears as if the future is bright for the Pacific Northwest soft white wheat class. Now, if I could only get a schedule for when all this future is going to happen. I hope you enjoyed episode 162 of Wheat All About It, the second part of what I called The Old World Order is Dead, Long Live the New World Order. from a presentation by Peter Zion, global strategist, author, and deep thinker about the future. Please think about making plans to attend next year's Tri-State Grain Growers Convention in Coeur d'Alene, and then join me here again next week for another episode of Weed All About It!
We're all children of a special treat, a miracle of nature that we just call wheat. A crop that's in the Bible, a crop that's in our bread, a crop that's filled our bellies and held us to its head. Through a history of starvation and times of want and woe, wheat has been our savior, our grub, our fuel, our dough. There's always lots of problems when we have enough to eat. But there's only one dilemma when it's not enough wheat. We feed you.